This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Bill Ayers about his new book, Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto.
It's a cliche to say this, but if you had one book on your bookshelf that you bought this year, it should be this book.
Renewed efforts are underway to call on President Obama to grant clemency to Oscar Lopez Rivera.
Lopez Rivera is a genuine hero back in his home country of Puerto Rico and here across the United States.
We'll look at a practice once outlawed but increasingly used, debtor's prison.
Another way to victimize the poor, people are now routinely sent to prison, particularly in the South, if they can't pay a fine.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
The presidential debate held last week between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton allowed us to take a sober measure of the calamitous situation we find ourselves in 15 years after 9/11. Bill Ayers' just published Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto, presents a different vision from those sketched out by the candidates and the economic, political, and cultural system which produced them. As Robin D.G. Kelly has written, Bill Ayers' vision for a humane future is incendiary. It incinerates old logics and illuminates new paths. If we do not end the violence of militarism, materialism, caging, dispossession, debts, want, ignorance, and global warming, our very survival is impossible. Bill Ayers is a social justice activist, teacher, distinguished professor of education, retired from the University of Illinois in Chicago, and the author of two memoirs, Fugitive Days and Public Enemy.
Bill Ayers, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell our audience a little bit about your background, how you became political, and why you wrote this book.
Well, I am now almost 72 years old, and I was first arrested, in that case opposing the war in Vietnam, in a demonstration when I was 20 years old. So it's been a long time. I got involved. I feel very lucky in some sense, very blessed to come of age, actually, at the moment when the Black Freedom Movement was really defining the moral landscape of our country. And I was drawn to it and then lifted up by it and then propelled into it. And when the war in Vietnam exploded, and I had come from a very privileged background, and I was in Ann Arbor at the time, a student at the University of Michigan, and when the war in Vietnam exploded, I found myself having my eyes opened for me, and I could see a world in flames. And that was both disturbing because it ran against all the mythology that I'd been raised with. It was discomforting because it shook me out of the privilege that was my birthright, and put me into a world that was so different than what I was raised with. And it's been a great, great adventure for over 50 years. This book is written almost as a pamphlet. My intention was to write something very short, very punchy, that tried to reframe the issues that we debate in this country. I feel the framing is all wrong on issue after issue. And yet I feel that on the issues that matter most to me, and I think to the two of you as well as most of your audience, we're in the majority in this country. I know that sounds odd coming from somebody who has a bit of a reputation as an ultra-leftist, but the reality is that on the big issues of the day, we actually find ourselves in the majority, and we should stop pretending that our ideas are either so precious that we can't express them or that we're so embattled that we have to barricade ourselves behind a wall. The reality is we have to get out there, talk to people, get away from the opportunism of politics as the art of the possible, and demand the impossible, and we'll find all kinds of allies.
Now, Bill, that full quote from your title is actually, be realistic, demand the impossible. What do you mean by that?
It was, yeah, and I think I attribute it to Che Guevara, but I've also heard that it was first written on the walls of the university in Paris in 1968. Wherever it comes from, I kind of love the sound of it. Be realistic, demand the impossible. Get out of the of the frame that we're stuck in, which makes our choices anemic and demands something more. And if you look at history, all the great revolutions, all the great movements have begun by demanding the impossible. Abolish slavery, for example.
In your first chapter, you write about your encounter with the Greek revolutionary Manilus, and you quote him saying that, "I'm interested in people discovering their own power." This is a profound thought, isn't it?
It is, and Manilus is famous throughout Europe and a national hero in Greece. He took the Nazi flag off the Acropolis when he was 14. His brother was killed by the Nazis. He was imprisoned and did lots of years in prison under the generals as well. But he has kept the faith to the point where I read just a few months ago in the New York Times that he was arrested in front of the Greek parliament at the age of, I think, 94 now. So he's never given it up. And we had a remarkable day together. And walking back to the dock to catch a boat, he said to me, just, you were quoting it, but the context is, he said, "I think you have the same problem in the United States that we have here in Greece. We could make a revolution if we had enough confidence in ourselves that if we took the risks, it would be worth it, it would pay off, and we ourselves can run our own affairs. It's not, we don't need to have our affairs run by others. We don't need a president and a prime minister and a general and a chief of police. We can do it ourselves."
Bill, can you explain what you mean when you write that we should question the dogma of common sense?
Well, you know, I think of dogma as a force that kind of shuts off our minds. And so we all know the dogma or the orthodoxy of a fundamentalist religion or of a fundamentalist politics. But one of the things we don't notice is that what we take for granted, that just comes to us in the air we breathe, is a certain kind of dogma as well. And so for example, in the days of slavery was just common sense. It's not something, people questioned it, but it was something we saw all around us, and everyone in one way or another participated in it. And so the dogma of common sense up until a couple of years ago included that we're going to have millions of our fellow citizens in prison, that prison was the dogma of common sense. That's being questioned now because some people have had the wisdom and the courage to demand the impossible, to say that we don't need to think of ourselves as a culture and a country that is filled with punishing regimes, and punishment is the normal course of events. Common sense, you know, is, I'll give you one example, Heidi, one example. Mark Twain wrote a wonderful, wonderful essay called "Free Speech is for the Grave." And in this essay, very short essay, Mark Twain talked about the fact that all of us want to be accepted by our neighbors. All of us want to think that we're good people. All of us want to get along in the world. And that means whatever is given to us, the world as such, is something we more or less go along with. And Twain goes on to say that the best example in my life is slavery. Everyone I know opposes slavery. No one I know stands up against it, because to stand up against it would be to stand up against the Constitution, the law, your parents, the founders, the Bible, your preacher, your neighbor. So why bother? Just go along with the common sense. That's dogma.
Another aspect, I think, or illustration of this is really our whole culture. You write that that we live in a culture of war. And could you elaborate on that, please?
Well, sure. I mean, we know, and your audience knows, that we have the biggest defense budget of any country in the world. In fact, it's bigger than the next 15 countries put together. We spend $1 trillion on war. Our economy is completely entangled in war. And it's something, again, that's just normal. It's normalized. So we play the Star-Spangled Banner, a war anthem, at athletic events. Now, look who just disrupted the common sense. I mean, what a wonderful moment when Colin Kaepernick from the San Francisco 49ers, he didn't have any guarantees that when he took a knee and refused to stand, that it would start a wildfire, and yet it did. And this is one of the remarkable things. It was an individual act that became a social phenomenon. I immediately, of course, bought a Colin Kaepernick jersey. I've been wearing it everywhere. gets a lot of nods and smiles when I was at Morgan State University 2 days ago. Gets a lot of derision other places. But the point is, Kaepernick took a knee just as Rosa Parks sat down and the world stood up. So Kaepernick had no guarantees that anything would happen, but here I am, for example, and you all are probably ahead of me on this, but I had never known that the Star Spangled Banner had a third stanza. And Kaepernick was objecting not only to the war anthem, but he was saying, I'm not going to honor a country in which the assassination of young black people on the streets is either condoned or ignored or not dealt with. And then you go and read the Star-Spangled Banner, and I urge you to Google Star-Spangled Banner third stanza. And there you read the celebration of the murder of freed slaves. Unbelievable. And Kaepernick did that. So that's what he was challenging the war culture. I think it's a war culture when you go to the airport and you're going through, getting ready to board a plane, and the clerk says, we'd like to have uniform military board first and thank you for your service. I always say to them, why don't we let the nurses and the teachers go in first and thank them for their service? Because the conflation of the word service with militarism is a culture of war.
Bill, your book has 8 or so chapters on different aspects of this culture, and one of them is prison. You make the connection between slavery and Jim Crow and prison bondage and mass incarceration, and you come out for the abolition of prison, which is really a striking idea, but when you think about it, a good idea. Talk to us about that, please.
Well, I learned this. I learned about the prison abolition movement from Angela Davis, from Bernadine Dorn, my partner, from Erica Miners, and other activists, from Michelle Alexander, who really exposed, you know, the role of prisons, the meaning of this institution of congealed violence, and why it's become so central in our country and such a defining aspect of our country. And it took me a while, but I realized that it's not enough, as Harry Blackmun said about the death penalty when he became a death penalty abolitionist, it's not enough to tinker with the machinery of death. We have to abolish it. And I've come to that same conclusion with prisons. But the interesting thing, Michael and Heidi, is that when you raise this in a public forum, people immediately think you've gone off the deep end and you've lost your mind. So I had the first experience, I raised it with a group of college students. In a longer talk, I threw out that I thought we should abolish the prisons. And, of course, the first question was from a young man who had encyclopedic knowledge about the serial killer John Wayne Gacy. And he said, well, don't we need a prison cell for John Wayne Gacy? And after he'd kind of exhausted me with everything he knew, I said, okay, one prison cell. Who else? And I said, I'll concede. I'll give you Bush and Cheney. But now we've got three prison cells. Why do we want to start with the assumption that wrongdoing or lawbreaking equals punishment equals prison? Could we think of something better? And then with that group, and I've done it ever since, we engaged in a little thought experiment. What are 1,000 things we could do as alternatives to prison? 1,000 things. And within minutes, we had a list of 20 or 25. So we were on our way. But it's things like restorative justice, meaning if harm is caused, the person who perpetrated the harm should, with the guidance of the community, take care of that harm. You don't want to, the point of somebody hurts somebody, somebody breaks a windshield, you don't want to compound that by imprisoning the window breaker. You want the window breaker to fix the window. And in 90% of the cases, restorative justice would be a great alternative to prison. But then let's go further. We need drug counseling. We need mental health. We need free health care. We need jobs. We need a decent public school in every neighborhood. This goes light years toward getting rid of prisons.
If listeners are just joining us, we're speaking with Bill Ayers, author of the new book, Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto. Bill, what were you trying to illustrate when you quoted James Carville stating, quote, it is the economy, stupid?
I don't know that I would hold up James Carville as a leading thinker on this, but that's in a chapter that I wrote called Shoulders to the Wheel, and it's an attempt to show that work and human labor is what our society relies on, depends on, and that the discussion we're having about human labor goes in many ways in the wrong direction. So I try to make a distinction in that chapter between jobs and work. And what I mean by that is a job is a job is a job, and that's all we hear about from the politicians and the industrialists. But that means that a job of growing a garden is the same as a job of being a prison guard or being a blackjack dealer. But it's not true. The work of the world is endlessly complicated and useful and necessary. But work is different than the monetized jobs economy. And the whole chapter is really an attempt to get away from the mystification of economics as this kind of rarefied thing that nobody could possibly understand and make it something that is understandable. And the chapter ends up pointing to the family. I always want to say, when you say the word family, you should note that dysfunctional is redundant. All families are dysfunctional, but they're also necessary. And what I mean by that is that when you look at a family, look at the family I was raised in, look at the family that I built with my own children, look at my neighbor's family. Families are based on a very simple principle, and the principle is from each according to their ability, to each according to their needs. That's sensible in a family. It's also sensible in a neighborhood and a city. It's sensible when we see one another as part of the human family, not some distinct alien from the human family. And if we can do it in a family and a community and a city, we can do it in a country and a world.
Bill, we're in the midst of a blazing carnival of national elections, and a lot of attention is on this coming election. Would you mind saying a few words about where we're at on that?
Well, my feeling is I'd love to talk for hours with you both about just that. But, you know, one of the things, I'll say a couple little observations. One is that I think people on the left get drawn too easily into the vortex of the national carnival, which is the elections with all of its light and fireworks and insanity. And what I mean by that isn't that we shouldn't pay attention. Of course, we should pay attention. And we should think thoughtfully and well about how we're going to cast our ballots and all that. But I think it's also important to know that voting takes you 5 minutes one day a year, one day every 4 years in the national elections. And yet, the other 364 days a year, we can access the sites of power that we know and that we participate in. So we spend a lot of time looking longingly at the sites of power we can't access, like the White House and the medieval auction block called the Congress, when we ought to spend much more energy looking at the sites of power like the school, the neighborhood, the university, the classroom, the workplace, the church, the mosque, the synagogue. These are sites of power we have real access to, and these are sites of power that in the long run matter. Having said that, I think we're in a very unique political moment. I think what the Trump campaign represents and what Trump represents is the coherence of a base that was not coherent several months ago. And it's always there, but it coheres irregularly. And that's a racist, nativist, white supremacist, jingoistic base. And these folks have come out of the woodwork and found one another in the vehicle of the Trump campaign. So defeating Trump is part of what needs to happen, but defeating the white supremacist, proto-fascist base that has found itself is a deeper and a more abiding problem. The other thing I would say about the election is that the Clinton campaign, because it occurs at a moment when Black Lives Matter is setting so much of the moral and political agenda, when Fight for 15 is on the ground, when undocumented and unafraid is active, when queer and here to stay is mobilized, at this moment, the Clinton campaign has been forced to look at some of the issues in ways that they wouldn't have normally done. That's great. That's to our credit. We should also recognize, and also because of the Bernie campaign, I should have mentioned that, it means that on January 21st, there is no honeymoon. On January 21st, those of us who are part of the progressive movement should be finding ourselves, making links, mobilizing ourselves to make the kind of agenda that in some ways the Democratic campaign platform committee came up with, and in some ways they missed the boat, and we should be in the streets demanding it and saying it loud.
Bill, I wanted to ask you to read a couple of paragraphs from your book. The penultimate chapter is called This American Dream, And on page 193, towards the bottom, you start out, "That possible other world is a world of socialism with participatory democracy and freedom." I wonder whether you could read that paragraph and then the second one.
You know, I'm arguing that standing right next to the world as such is always a possible world, and accessing the world that ought to be is part of our job. So the paragraph reads, "That possible other world is a world of socialism with participatory democracy and freedom, a world in which the needs of people come before profit and active participation is constantly mobilized. Explicitly rejecting capitalism is essential for movement builders today. Capitalism has no answers to the crises we face, and zombie capitalism, casino capitalism, Wizard of Oz capitalism is in fact the root of the problems. Insisting that the socialist alternative we fight for is inseparably tied to democracy is also indispensable. We must create a space where workers of every type plan, manage, and control in order to satisfy social needs. Authentic democracy mobilizes the capacities of working folks and the broad masses of people to define the society we want and need, embracing the revolutionary practice of simultaneously changing circumstances and changing ourselves."
Could you conclude with the last thought, "We reject the logic of the rich"?
"We reject the logic of the rich and the powerful. We rethink and recast issues in more robust and human frames. We connect the issues in order to find our natural allies and comrades and to develop a more comprehensive view. Whoever we are and wherever we work and play, we must remind ourselves that movements don't make themselves. It's up to each and all of us to arise every day with our minds set on freedom and to commit to movement building as a regular and required part of what we do." And what I don't say there, Michael, is we should go to bed every night disappointed that once again we failed to overthrow capitalism, but that should not discourage us. We should rise up the next morning with our minds set on freedom.
Absolutely. You know, Bill, I think that this is a profound book, a real gift that you've articulated for our generation to pass on to the next. And I hope that all of our listeners will get it. It's called Demand the Impossible, a Radical Manifesto by Bill Ayers. Bill, tell us about the structure of the book. You've got these wonderful indexes like Harper's Index in front of every chapter. Can you talk about the different chapters in the index and what you're trying to do by that?
Well, you know, I wanted it to be a pamphlet, something you could put in your back pocket and read on the bus. And it is a small book. But the chapters are very simple. They're framed. There are 8 substantive chapters. They're framed by a beginning and a beginning again. And the beginning is possible worlds, and the beginning again is my American dream. But in between, each chapter is like a bumper sticker: disarm, stop the cops, teach freedom, love the earth, and so on. And each of those chapters begins with a one-page Harper's-type index. And what I'm trying to do with that is, I've always found the Harper's Index quite amusing and sometimes quite illuminating. What I'm trying to do is say very simply, with a couple of figures, this is the problem, and this is what we need to fight toward. And that's really the theme of the book, is really to say, many of us know what the problems are. We're pretty good at analyzing them, but we need to also know what we're fighting for in order to have guidance for the strategies and tactics that we come up with. We don't want to go off the deep end. So the Harper's Index beginnings is just an attempt to in a very pithy way, say what we're talking about. So in the chapter on war, I talk about the billions and trillions that we spend on war, and we can contrast it, and also the big capitalist corporations, Halliburton and so on, who get rich on war, and how entangling that is. I try to contrast that with, you know, what we spend on peace. And it's the same with education. Education, as you know, is one of my main focuses of my energy for a long, long time. The rich and the powerful spend enormous sums of money on their own children, where they starve the schools for poor kids in places like Chicago and New York, Cleveland and Los Angeles. That differential is what I'm trying to say is the problem. And then I try to lay out what the solution might be.
Bill, we just have 1 minute left. We wanted to remark that the tone of your book is sunny and optimistic, unusual for a radical declaration. Why is that?
You know, I don't think of myself as an optimist, Heidi. I think of myself as a person who's decided to embrace a politics of confidence and a politics of hopefulness. Optimism is deterministic, just like pessimism. Optimists and pessimists think they know what's going to happen. I know for sure that I don't know what's next. And I've got lots of examples from my own life and from history. But since history has surprised us before, and history can surprise us again, in fact, we can be the agents of that surprise, I choose to be a hopeful person. I don't know what's coming, but I know that what we do or don't do will make the difference.
Absolutely. Our friend Ramsey Clark said on this program that you have to have hope, because if you don't have any hope, you don't do anything.
No, you become cynical. You know, if I could say one more thing, could I say one more thing?
Yes, sure. Please do.
Okay. You all probably saw the debates the other night. I've done this little exercise. I was at Busboys and Poets on a panel with Medea Benjamin and Jared Ball and others. But one of the things that we did that night was we asked ourselves, what questions would we ask the candidates if we were sitting in the chair? And it's a really good thought experiment, because it shows the anemic quality of that kind of entertainment. And so the kind of questions we came up with were things like this: should Edward Snowden be pardoned or given the Presidential Medal of Freedom? How about Leonard Peltier, Oscar Lopez, Mutulu Shakur? That was one question. What are five steps you would advocate to begin to attack mass incarceration? Do you agree that the Palestinian people should enjoy the rights of all peoples? Would you insist that Israel stop all settlements? Would you support the Gandhian movement in Palestine known as boycott, divest, and sanction, and so on? But it was a lot of fun as an exercise, because you see what's missing in the national discourse and the frames that we need to change.
We love your questions, Bill.
Bill, you've written a magnificent book that we urge our audience to get. It's called Demand the Impossible by Bill Ayers. Just came out. It's a radical manifesto published by Haymarket Books. You can get it now. It's out there. Please get a copy, read it, and put it in your back pocket. You'll be enriched from the experience. Bill Ayers, it's been a joy to have you on Law and Disorder.
Mike and Heidi, I can't thank you enough. Thanks so much, and keep on your good work.
Thanks, Bill. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
A growing movement is calling for the release of 72-year-old Puerto Rican nationalist Oscar Lopez Rivera, who has served 35 years in prison, 12 of them in solitary confinement at Maximax prisons. In 1980, 11 members of the FALN were arrested for a series of bomb attacks on banks, government facilities, and military sites across the United States in protest against the U.S. colonization of Puerto Rico. Although named as a co-defendant in the case, Lopez Rivera was not arrested until a year later, picked up during a traffic stop, and charged with seditious conspiracy, weapons possessions, and transporting stolen vehicles across state lines. No evidence was ever found tying Lopez Rivera to any of the bombings, and although he was not convicted of any violent crimes, he was sentenced to 55 years in federal prison. 15 more years were added later to his sentence for an alleged escape attempt. Most Puerto Ricans and human rights advocates view Lopez Rivera with enormous respect for his work as a civil rights activist and community organizer in Chicago. He is a decorated war veteran, having been awarded the Bronze Star Medal during his service in the U.S. Army in Vietnam. In 1999, President Bill Clinton offered all FALN members, including Lopez Rivera, conditional clemency. Lopez Rivera declined the offer because the deal included a condition that he serve an additional 10 years in prison, that he renounce the struggle, and because two of his co-defendants would be left behind. Supporters are now collecting signatures on a petition that asks Barack Obama to issue a presidential pardon that grants his immediate release. Joining us to talk about efforts to bring Lopez Rivera home is his attorney, Jan Sussler from the People's Law Office in Chicago. A longtime member of the National Lawyers Guild, she has also represented Puerto Rican political prisoners for over three decades. We're also joined by Alejandro Molina from the Campaign to Free Oscar Lopez.
Jan Sussler and Alejandro Molina, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yes, thank you for the invitation.
Tell us, how is Oscar's spirit and his health after 34 years in prison?
Well, actually, it's 35, Heidi. Scandalous. Many more years even than Nelson Mandela was in prison. But as we all saw Nelson Mandela leave prison with his head held high and his fist in the air, that's really the spirit that Oscar embodies. No matter what they've tried to do to him to break his spirit and really break his political commitment, it hasn't worked. He's got a wonderful sense of humor, a wonderful smile. He's fit. He's 73, but he's fit, and he's ready for whatever the world and history brings him.
Can you briefly remind our listeners about the history and the details of the case? Why wasn't Oscar arrested until a year after the other members of the FALN were?
We probably should even back up a little bit further, because how the United States gets to keep Puerto Rico as a colony means really keeping U.S. people ignorant about the relationship between the two countries.
Right.
So I think if we start just briefly by saying that in 1898, the U.S. invaded militarily the island of Puerto Rico and took it as war booty after the war ended, and imposed, really, colonial regime. And ever since then, even previous to that, because it was a Spanish colony, the Puerto Rican people resisted, and like any peoples in the world, wanted to determine their own destiny. So Oscar is part of a very long and proud tradition among the Puerto Rican people to demand the human rights of self-determination and independence. So there's several generations of Puerto Rican political prisoners. Oscar's is the latest. There were people arrested in April of 1980 in Chicago, 11 people. Oscar was indicted with them for seditious conspiracy, which in lay people's terms is conspiring to use force against the authority of the United States over Puerto Rico.
It's a political crime, wouldn't you say?
Very much. Very much. And it's really almost the same crime that Nelson Mandela was imprisoned for in South Africa under apartheid. Oscar was arrested a year later, and all of those arrests were really not because the FBI had done any kind of genius investigative work. It was kind of pure accident both times. But they ended up in prison with sentences that ranging from 55 to 90 years. And that, I think, is significant because they weren't convicted of hurting or killing anybody. They were convicted of conspiring, basically, to commit what the United Nations calls a legitimate effort to end the crime against humanity, which is colonialism. And so, yes, that Oscar has a 55-year sentence for seditious conspiracy, and then he was given an additional 15 years after an FBI-made plot to trap him and other members of the independence movement. So he's serving a sentence of 70 years. He's been in prison half of his life, and he's served half of that sentence already. You know, it's the sentence is disproportionate, the amount of time he served is disproportionate, the kind of conditions he's been subjected to in prison are not the same as a social prisoner is subjected to.
In 1999, President Bill Clinton offered Oscar conditional clemency. Now, why did he refuse?
First, let's put that in context. The president wasn't like giving a gift to him. The president was really ceding to an international campaign, which was demanding the unconditional release of all the Puerto Rican political prisoners. And what Mr. Clinton did was, I think, tried to kind of split the baby in half, and he granted conditional release to most of the prisoners, but not all. And he didn't include two prisoners at all in his offer of commutation. And to Oscar, he made, as you said, Heidi, a very special offer, which was serve an additional 10 years in prison with very clean conduct, and then we'll let you go under the same conditions as the others, which was basically parole. And Oscar did the same thing he did when he was in Vietnam, after having been drafted, like many young Puerto Ricans and African Americans and poor white people. His platoon was under an ambush. Many of the people were injured and killed. And instead of running for his life, he stayed and helped build a landing strip so that the rescue helicopters could come and take out the wounded and the dead. And he got the Bronze Star for that. Well, it's really the same kind of embracing the whole, embracing the community that he's part of. And he said, well, I'm not going to run for my life. I'm going to stay until everybody's out. And that's what he did. And now everybody's out. We have a commutation petition pending with President Obama that's been pending since 2010.
I'm remembering when Clinton made that disgraceful offer. He also pardoned the financial swindler Mark Rich, who was a big contributor to the Democratic Party. What do people in Puerto Rico think about Oscar? And what's the movement looking like now?
Oh, my goodness. Oscar is really a household name in Puerto Rico. There's really, I think, never in the history of Puerto Rico been the kind of support for a Puerto Rican that Oscar enjoys. The governor actually went to the prison to visit Oscar, which is unprecedented. And he wasn't, the governor was not in favor of independence, and he didn't even support what Oscar did. But he really is very smitten with the idea that Oscar represents the dignity of Puerto Rico. And that's a very, very commonly held view of Oscar. He is held up as somebody who struggles for what he believes in, doesn't give up, holds his head high. And that's the kind of dignity that the Puerto Rican people are very much about, particularly in the face of this new iteration of colonialism called PROMESA, this new terrible law that imposes a fiscal control board that really takes over the democratic government of Puerto Rico. But the governor is not alone. The unions, the churches, civic society, the president of the Bar Association went to go visit Oscar. Actually, every time Obama commutes the sentences of some of the drug offenders, which actually is a move that we applaud, people in Puerto Rico lament the fact that Oscar has not yet been released. And the governor makes public statements every time there's a commutation. That foundation for that clamor for Oscar's release has very much been catching. It's caught on in the diaspora in the United States. It's caught on beyond the diaspora in the United States to unions, SEIU, AFSCME, AFL-CIO, LACLA. All these unions have passed resolutions supporting his release. City councils, including the New York City Council, the speaker of which has been to visit Oscar. Churches, and then it's caught on internationally as well. And so I think that fervor of Puerto Rican dignity that Oscar represents is something that is inspiring really an international campaign. And maybe it's time to talk about October 9th.
What kind of events are coming up that our listeners should know about, and how can they find out more?
Alejandro, well, take it away.
I would say first well, we have been in the last month, both up and down the East Coast, very active, and in the Midwest, active in building community events as well as gatherings and meetings with churches and elected officials around October 9th. October 9th, the coalition in Puerto Rico, which is the Coalition for the Liberation of Oscar López Rivera, and the campaign in the United States, primarily led by the Boricua Human Rights Network and the New York-based Coordinadora to Free Oscar López, have met when had events, cultural and political events, in New York City, in Holyoke and Springfield, in Hartford City Hall, with Congressman Gutierrez, with Jose Lopez, the brother of Oscar Lopez, Another one with Clarisa Lopez, the daughter of Oscar Lopez, who's very active in the campaign. And we're hoping to culminate all of these with thousands of people rallying for an interfaith freedom convocation and cultural celebration on Sunday, October 9th at Lafayette Park in front of the White House from 12, starting at noon. There'll be music. There'll be short prayer. But a lot of it will be about the support for Oscar.
We're speaking with Oscar Lopez Rivera's attorney, attorney for a long time, Jan Sussler from the People's Law Office, and Alejandro Molina, who's organizing the campaign to free Oscar Lopez. Is there a website that our listeners can go to learn about this and get involved?
Yes, there are two websites. The one in the U.S. is BoricuaHumanRights.org. That's BoricuaHumanRights.org. Has the latest videos by Lin-Manuel, by the congressman, by Melissa Margarito, asking people to come out in October. And the one in Puerto Rico is freeoscarlopeznow.com, where you can also donate to help defray the cost of this amazing production.
Thank you very much. Jan, Alejandro, it's been great to have you on Law and Disorder. Good luck on the campaign, and Oscar Lopez Rivera, if somehow you can hear us, good luck to you. We're with you all the way. Thank you
Michael
so much, folks.
Michael and Heidi, thank you so much for having us, and thank you so much for continuing the program after Michael's passing. We miss him so much.
Thanks, Jan.
Thank you, Jan.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. 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 It has been nearly 200 years since this country abolished the practice of imprisoning those who failed to pay their debts. Recently, however, many impoverished persons face the modern equivalent of debtor's prison in the form of unfair legal practices in local courts. More and more courts are charging fees to those convicted of crimes, including fees for public defenders, prosecutors, court administration, jail operation, and probation supervision by private companies. Aggressive and often illegal tactics are employed to collect unpaid fines and fees, including for traffic offenses and other low-level offenses. These courts have ordered the arrest and jailing of people who lag behind in payments without offering hearings to determine an individual's ability to pay or to provide alternatives to payment, such as community service. The human toll of such practices is staggering. Coercive debt collection means that poor individuals may forego basic necessities of life, such as food and clothing, to avoid arrest. Debtors' prisons increase government costs and waste taxpayer money by jailing people who may never be able to pay their debts. Finally, debtors' prisons result in racial injustice and a two-tiered system in which the poor receive harsher, longer punishments. Joining us to talk about this new trend is Sarah Garrity. Sarah is the managing attorney of the Impact Litigation Unit at the Southern Center for Human Rights. Sarah Garrity, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
What is debtor's prison?
Well, debtor's prison means is exercised in a number of different ways in our court system. But the way we see it most often right now in our law practice is when someone gets a ticket, often a traffic ticket, isn't able to pay that traffic ticket and goes to jail because they can't afford to pay for it.
How widespread is the problem, and are there certain states that are worse than others?
The problem is widespread, and it's been getting a lot of attention in recent years. Certainly, people are aware of the Department of Justice's report in Ferguson, showing that the city court there was being used as a sort of money-making enterprise for the municipality. And unfortunately, that happens in a lot of places, not just Ferguson. It certainly happens here in my home state of Georgia. We've seen the courts in recent years, especially our lower courts, our misdemeanor and our traffic courts, really emphasize the goal of money collection over other more legitimate priorities like public safety, protecting public safety, and more legitimate goals like that.
Can you give us a case study or two so we can gauge the impact that this has on human lives?
I certainly can. The first one that comes to mind is a man that we represented this summer. He's a cook and a single dad up in North Georgia, and he got a traffic ticket for driving without a license on his person. Because he couldn't afford to pay the fine on or before the day of court, he was placed on probation with a private company. The amount that he owed to the court went up a lot because he had to pay probation supervision fees to this private company. So this man is a law-abiding guy. He reported for about 7 months. He paid in small increments as best he could. And then he fell on hard times. He had some health issues. He had to have surgery. The restaurant where he worked closed for remodeling, and he couldn't afford to keep up his payments. And as happens in so many cases, he was told by his probation officer that if he didn't continue his payments, he'd be sent to jail. And so he stopped reporting. And not long after that, police arrived at his house in the middle of the night, 4 a.m., and arrested him, took his son into state custody, and took this man to jail. And so I think what this story illustrates, and we do see these things happening on a fairly regular basis, what it illustrates is that it has become normalized to send someone to jail and to take away his children over a traffic ticket, and that should be really disturbing to all of us, I think.
Now, Sarah, you mentioned the company that was in charge of overseeing him. Is there a lot of privatization along with the courts that are allowing this to happen?
There is a lot of privatization, especially in many of the southern states, Georgia, Tennessee, Mississippi. Here in Georgia, we have the highest number of people on probation in the country by far, the highest number and the highest rate. We have about a quarter of a million people on misdemeanor probation in Georgia.
Misdemeanor probation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's about four times as high as the next highest jurisdiction. One of the reasons that we have so many people on probation in Georgia is because we have a booming private probation industry. Right now, about 80% of people on misdemeanor probation in Georgia are supervised by private companies. So the industry really does have a strong foothold in this state, and we've seen a lot of abuses.
But, you know, that seems to defy common sense, because the cost of supervising people who have committed misdemeanors would seem to contradict the need for these jurisdictions to raise additional funds, because that adds costs to the criminal defense process.
Well, the way in which these the industry is justified, that those who support the industry say that the offender-funded model, is what it's called, is a good thing because it takes the costs of running the criminal justice system off of the taxpayers and transfers them to the, quote, offender. And so that the appeal to many of the governing entities that contract with these companies is that the government does not have to pay for the costs of probation supervision. I think there are a number of problems with that analysis. One of them is that as a consequence of our booming private probation industry, one, there is a financial incentive to have as many people on probation for as long as possible. And two, we're sweeping so many people into the criminal justice system who are not criminals, who have never been criminals, and who simply don't need to be ensnared in the criminal justice system. You know, I do some speaking at colleges here in Georgia sometimes, and I've been struck recently by how often I'm approached by college students who take me aside after the talk and say, you know, I'm a straight-A student, but I'm on probation. And I hear this a lot, and we've reached a point at which it's really become normalized to put too many people on probation, to trap too many people in our criminal justice system who really don't need to be there.
We're speaking with Attorney Sarah Garrity of the Impact Litigation Unit at the Southern Center for Human Rights. Sarah, there's a significant case called Bearden versus Georgia, and we wanted to ask you about that case and also federal laws and state laws that relate to debtors' courts.
Sure. So Bearden versus Georgia is a 1983 Supreme Court case, and it has to do with what a judge is supposed to do when he or she is confronted with a probation revocation hearing for someone who allegedly has not paid a fine or fee associated with a criminal case. And what the Supreme Court said in that case is that we're not supposed to send people to jail for their inability to pay a fine unless there is a judicial finding that the failure to pay was willful and that there are no alternatives to incarceration. So that is that if you've got someone who just doesn't have the money, who receives supplemental security income, someone who just cannot pay, that alone is not a reason to send someone to jail. There has to be a finding by a judge that the failure to pay was willful.
This is quite astonishing, Sarah. How can current courts ignore the Supreme Court's holdings from Bearden? And can the Justice Department intervene?
Two responses to that. I mean, I think that in part as a result of the excellent work by the Department of Justice in over the past year, some of the smaller courts, misdemeanor and traffic courts around this nation are getting the message that the Supreme Court outlawed this practice a long time ago. The Department of Justice has been very active in this area in the last year, issued a letter to many people throughout the country who work in the justice system, reminded them of the mandate of Bearden versus Georgia. We are seeing some improvements in some of our courts. For example, here in Georgia, the Judicial Council just issued a bench card that it intends to promulgate throughout the state that reminds judges of their constitutional duties in these kinds of cases and provides very specific guidance about how to deal with indigent people who come before the court and for misdemeanors and traffic offenses.
And can you talk briefly about how your work at the Southern Center for Human Rights interfaces with this issue, if at all?
I sure can. You know, we get a lot of complaints from people about their experience in court. I'll tell one additional story. We represented a man down in South Georgia who received a ticket for burning leaves in his yard without a permit. This is a gentleman who has an intellectual disability, an African-American man in his 50s. He didn't have the money to pay the $500 fine. So when he came before the court, only because he couldn't pay, he was placed on probation with a private company that lumped an additional $528 in, quote, supervision fees onto this man's case, bringing his total to $1,028 for burning leaves in his yard. And then what happened next was quite extraordinary. He was whisked away from the judge's bench to a room adjacent to the court, and he met with a probation officer who told him that he needed to make an immediate down payment, day of court payment, or he would be taken to jail. And when he couldn't do that, sure enough, he was taken to jail, where he remained until one of his family members bailed him out. This same man was made efforts to pay over the year of his probation. And at the end of the probation year, the probation officer continued to tell him that he needed to report and that he needed to pay, even though his probation sentence was over and he had no further obligation to the court. You know, here is someone who is not a criminal, didn't need to be on probation at all, but this is the way that unfortunately, in too many instances, this is the way people are treated. We get calls about this with some frequency at our office. At our office, we do impact litigation, but we also provide a direct representation in many cases like this. And we're working hard to, with partners in the government, with legislators and with others, to try to change the way that courts approach these kinds of cases. The risk of doing nothing is that people start to lose faith in their local courts, and I think that's a really dangerous thing.
Very good point. How does this play out in terms of racial disparities, if at all?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an excellent question. Anecdotally speaking, I can say that there is a very significant and I would think disparate impact on African Americans here in Georgia. But the difficulty with proving that is that we have a real absence of data here in Georgia. Race is not a category that is mandated to be on our uniform traffic citations. And the records that come out of these courts are kept in the individual courts. There's not a lot of centralized record keeping. Certainly, we see in our day-to-day work the disparate impact that that these kinds of practices have on communities of color here in Georgia.
Sarah, what, if anything, can our listeners do about this situation?
Well, you know, one thing I'd say is that people can have, reasonable people can have varying views on privatization of government functions. After 10 years of representing people in the misdemeanor and traffic courts of this state, I feel like I can say with some certainty that the private probation is a failed experiment. It is impossible to divorce the profit motive from these proceedings in cases in which private probation companies are involved. So that if you see the industry headed the way of your state, I would say that the time to resist it is when people in the legislature are talking about bringing this sort of model to your state. It's a model that really should not spread out of the South, where it is primarily concentrated right now. Well, and the other thing I would say is this. I think this is an important point and probably applies broadly to the courts across the nation. We need to stop looking at our municipal courts as moneymakers for the city. That is not an appropriate use of our city courts. And when citizens come to court and see that the primary motive of this institution is revenue generation, it really undermines people's confidence in their local systems of justice.
Very well said, Sarah. We have run out of time, but this has been fascinating, and it's really been a pleasure to speak with you today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Yeah, Sarah Garrity of the Southern Center for Human Rights, it's been very, very good having you on the show, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.